Okay, today is, what is today? June 9th, 2015. This is an oral history interview with Dave Westring. We are here at Steenbach Memorial Library inside the University Archives. My name is Troy Reeves with the UW-Madison Oral History Center. Dave, for sound quality purposes, could you say your name and spell your last name?
My name is David Westring, W-E-S-T-R-I-N-G.
Great. Looks like it'll pick us up just fine. So, Dave, as I said before we started, that one of the first things I wanted to ask you is the bulk of your time, bulk of what we're going to talk about is your time in med school here, but I wanted to ask first if you had sort of pre-med school memories of UW.
Yes. The first was my father bringing me here to Madison to convince me to go to school here where he had graduated. And he did that by one summer afternoon driving me over from Milwaukee and taking me directly to the Union Terrace. And that did the trick. I was enthralled and ready to come here. I then entered in 1951 in a pre-medical course. In those days, pre-medicine was acceptable as a three-year course, so that I took a prescribed course that allowed perhaps not enough humanities, but a lot of labs and a lot of science, with the major of medical sciences, and then I would be expected to get a bachelor's degree. After my first year of medical school, the bachelor's degree would be in medical sciences. I think this was a holdover from the shortening of medical school in World War II. And not many years after I graduated, the pre-medical curriculum was expanded to 4 years. So pre-medicine was not as bad as I had anticipated. I had heard all the stories about how competitive it was. But you began to know who was in pre-med, not by asking them always or by them telling you, but rather by seeing them in your classes all the time. And we became kind of a group that I did not feel in heavy competition with. That was not because I was confident of my acceptance into the school, but I knew I wanted to go to school here, and most of them did too. But I was aware of the competition, and we didn't talk about our grades. We didn't really talk about how well we did on exams. We just might complain or would talk about a question, but that was really the spirit of it, and it was not an unpleasant time for me. Mm-hmm. On entering medical school then, I found that most of the people I thought would be my classmates were there. We were alphabetized. There were 84 of us. So I really got to know the group best who were back in the T's, or S's, through the W's and the Z, and we had a Z. There were 84 admissions. I think that was the class size then. I know it's 127 now. I think the other interesting thing about, in general, about the class was that we had what we were told was an extraordinarily large number of women. I believe it was 9. And I do remember the conversations about that. First of all, they tended to kind of stay to themselves. And maybe that's understandable, because the prevailing attitude, I do remember the discussions, was that what a shame that those women were admitted, because they were depriving breadwinners, who were then men usually, of their chosen field. as an afterthought, looking back, they were wonderful members. One or two dropped out, but the ones who stayed with us have done very, very well, and I'm very proud of them. They were courageous. They were particularly compassionate people who went on and expressed that in their careers. And probably the most notable was Gloria Sarto, who is a professor of obstetrics even now and has developed the women's program here.
Dave, can I jump in here? There's a few things I want to ask before we
sure.
get deeper into the med school. So you were living in Milwaukee in the early 50s?
That's correct, yes. That's where I grew up.
Okay.
It was a suburb of Milwaukee.
Okay. And did you do most of your undergrad somewhere else?
No, I did it here.
Okay. You just were able to...
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes.
So when you got here in 51, where did you live?
In 51, I lived in the dormitory system, Jones Hall, which was way out at the end of the campus at that time. The athletic fields were out there as they are now. And it was the beginning of the pathway that I walked all the time. And I remember it well. It's now called the Howard Temin. And Howard Temin had a little piece in my life that I can touch on later.
Yeah, let's make sure we remember that.
Mm-hmm.
I'll make a note. So is Jones Hall still extant, or is it?
It's there, and it seems to be still a dormitory, yes. Okay. Men's dorm.
So you said the major in med science, you started to figure out who your cohorts were because they were in class with you.
Yes.
Any specific names or people who became more memorable to you?
Let me think about that. My anatomy partner, of course, would be the one I remember. That's who I spent the most time with, certainly in the freshman year. And that was Henry Rahr, R-A-H-R. He's retired now, but living in De Pere, I think. And I've seen him fairly recently, within the last few years. Bill Kotange was an interesting fellow because he took on the responsibility of directing MediChoir, which was a chorus of medical students, and I joined that. And recently looking at a class picture, I noticed that most of it was made up of my classmates, the chorus at that time. Interesting to me. There was the comedian was Van Giesen. I forgot his first name. But just a fun fellow. Clark Danforth was a roommate for 2 years. Became a neurologist. And last but perhaps mostly, it's John Bryant Wyman, or known as Bry. And Bry married while he was in medical school and lived down the street from me off of Orchard. So I walked to class with him almost every day. Mm. And with another W, he always sat very close to me. Mm. And finally, I remember John Weiss, who was also a very funny guy. He would... the day the six-year war occurred in Israel in our freshman year, I think it was the freshman year, and he sat next to me, and he turned to me. He was Jewish, of course, and he turned to me with a big smile on his face, and he said, today, Suez, tomorrow, the world. Yeah, I think those were the memorable people, except that I didn't interact with her much, but Gloria Sarto is now somebody I remember, and Daryl Treffert was went into psychology and has made a big name for himself. He's, I think, one of our class celebrities.
So So during undergrad, as you're getting ready for med school, where were some of the places that you would go to study?
Well, my favorite place to study, and it started in pre-med, was the Rathskeller. I had a table right in the bay window looking out over the lake, which was frozen much of the time, of course. But I don't recall, that might have been true sometimes because I moved to another home, another room after starting medical school. And it was close to the Rathskeller. The thing is about medical school is there was really no study time. We were in classes or almost all day or on the wards or in anatomy. The classes in the freshman year were all in that, and the sophomore too pretty much were all biochemistry and physiology and anatomy. Anatomy was then a huge course. It was 6 days a week, 8:45 or 8:50, is that when it starts? till noon. And most of us, I think, did not finish at the end of the year. That was a full year of that. And we had to stay into the summer for a while to finish the examination. It was heavily stressed.
So where would you go on campus then? You know, we talked about studying, talked about sort of where you lived, but where would you go to, you know, to, as the kids would call today, hang out?
Yeah. I do not have many memories of that. I remember even spending my evenings. I'm trying to remember, by the time I got to medical school, I, for the first year, lived on over near the Union on, I don't remember the name of the street, but Delta Tau Delta, as the fraternity was across the street from the building. I remember that. And it was close to Science Hall, which is anatomy. It was also a neuroanatomy or neuropathology. So that, and the evenings I studied, and weekends pretty much too. In fact, I'm learning in my years now how much of the world I missed then. All the music that my peers go back and enjoy, and we go to the concerts to listen to the famous groups and the famous singers of the times. I never heard that music. I didn't go to those things. I didn't listen to the radio much. I studied a lot. And especially the first 2 years, which was basically, in those days, rote memory. And it still is. I'm sure it still has to be for chemistry and to some extent physiology. So it was not a big hangout time.
Another thing I wanted to ask again that is pre-med school is your interest in medicine. Yes. When did you get that interest in medicine?
I dated it to age 14 when I had appendicitis. And my pediatrician was called to my home and made the diagnosis of acute appendicitis and sent me off to the hospital. I don't remember the surgeon, but I remember that was when I thought it was a pleasant experience all in all, and I would want it to be a part of that. And I that was it. So I was fortunate, I find, from other people in my family and in the world in general, that I came to school knowing exactly what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And what course I wanted to take. And it was always exciting and fun. Mm-hmm.
So one more thing, even though you said that you studied a lot and don't have a lot of memories of hanging out, I'm wondering if you watched any of the Badger athletics.
Yeah, I'm sure I went to some of the football games. Same with basketball. Did not engage in any athletics myself that I can recall. Maybe played tennis when the weather was conducive. I like to swim, and I would occasionally swim over at the Red Gym, where it's where the men's pool was then. I'm surprised I don't remember hanging out in bars at all. I'm sure I did. And in those days, they were the pub and the Brat House, which is still there and under another name. And there were others, but I would imagine I would go with a few of my friends. Some of them, like Bri Wyman, was married. I do remember dating, and it was mostly nurses that we got to know, nurses in the hospital. Mm-hmm. But I did not even allow myself a romance, really, at that time. I had several girlfriends, one that got pretty serious.
So I think that's all of my sort of pre-med school questions.
Mm-hmm.
So your first year of med school, from what you've told me and what you've said here, was really like your last year of undergrad, is that?
That's correct, yes.
Okay. I assume though you consider that med school?
Oh yes, okay. Yeah. I my attitude about it was that I was in med school. I was welcomed, of course, to the graduation ceremony for my bachelor's degree, and I didn't go. I felt that the graduation I was looking forward to would be the MD.
So after that first year then, mm-hmm. and it sounds like the first year was primarily classwork.
The structure of the school was divided into two halves. The first 2 years were called the basic sciences. And they included, it wasn't much different than pre-med. It was pretty much the same faces and just new courses, tougher courses, with a lot of labs. Physiology was doing experiments on each other, on dogs, on ourselves. So there was a lot of lab time, and that's why I didn't hang out anywhere. You had a whole afternoon of physiology, you had a morning of one of the other ones. Mm-hmm. So the first 2 years were followed that way. Our class was the first to undergo a curriculum transition, and that was the third year was to be the same, except that in the third year, there was the beginning of a clinical introduction, which was called Introduction to Clinical Medicine at that time, or physical diagnosis. And that was where we were, where we purchased a white coat, a short white coat, a stethoscope, and an otoscope, a blood pressure sphygmomanometer. And learn to do that on each other, to examine each other. You could always tell the junior medical student, well, I'm backing up. So the first 2 years were pretty straight science classes. The third year had been, right up to us, more classes, lectures all day on the liver, the heart, the lung, the blood system, things like that. That was dropped with a few occasional lectures during the week. They were usually at noontime, and we would go on rounds in the mornings with the clinical team. And so the third and fourth year then become the clinical years. And so the third year started to require more reading on the diseases themselves by virtue that you would see those patients in the course of the rounds or the clinics. So you also attended a clinic, can't remember, once or twice a week, I think, where you just sort of stood and watched a professor see a patient. And that was a kind of a pleasant experience. It was valuable, certainly, and certainly better than sitting in on lectures about liver and spleen. So, and then I guess to finish that up, sure. The fourth year, it was a clinical year in which you spent 3 months as a preceptor being sent to another part of the state and actually work with a practicing physician. They were almost always internists or family practitioners who made rounds and saw patients in their hospitals and their office hours with one-on-one education at that point. The rest of that time you were assigned to various courses which you could take. I don't recall how much of that was done then. The subspecialties, for example, you could choose, there was an elective point, and that was usually supposed to have something to do with your a term paper or a research project. And that was in the fourth year. And I guess that would be equivalent to a doctorate thesis, was the idea. But I don't think in any way was it ever as rigorous as the doctorate thesis I know about. Mm-hmm.
So, Dave, I'm going to jump in here. Mm-hmm. Earlier on, a couple minutes ago, you said you tested on dogs and you tested on each other.
Yes.
I think I'd be remiss if I didn't ask a little bit,
yes,
to have you elaborate a bit more on that.
Okay. The each other part was... that was where we learned to draw blood, take a blood pressure. But in the physiology lab, the drawing blood was to have a sample that we might apply then in biochemistry class, if I recall, and do a test on that, doing studies on that. One of the tests on ourselves that I remember very well was the Christmas holidays of that sophomore year. We were studying the chemistry of nutrition, and we were expected before the holidays to choose a specified diet that would either be high in carbohydrate, high in fat, or high in protein, and then limit ourselves to that diet during the holiday period. I think we must have gotten Christmas Day off if we didn't have to do that. But and then take notes and keep track of our weight and all of that sort of thing. And I remember personally choosing carbohydrates, and I had to eat it. You had to get up to the number of calories. You had to meet the caloric requirement. So I had to eat a large number of high-calorie fruits and vegetables. That meant prunes and raisins and dried fruits and bananas and a lot of that. And I remember I ended up with diarrhea. But we compared notes after the holidays, and everybody had something to complain about. Another one was we learned to pass a nasogastric tube, and that we did on ourselves if we could. I could not, so my partner in the class then had to do it. But I have a deviation of a septum in my nose, and that was the way to go. And nobody could get past that. We had to go down my throat. And at that time, I had a good, strong gag reflex. So that was not a happy time. It was a long, difficult day. I got the trick of it and did it many times thereafter on patients.
And so the dogs?
The dogs. Yeah. That was not fun. They had a dog lab that was strays, I guess. A lot of them were beautiful dogs, and I remember only doing that once. And it was to observe how the heart stops, I think, in the long run. But we did, but there was a little operative technique. We scrubbed for it. We had an instructor, and I think three of us at the table. We anesthetized the dog, and then opened him up and kind of checked out the anatomy, looked at the abdominal viscera, and then gave drugs to watch the heart beat fast or slow, and eventually gave a lethal dose. And we had a beautiful German Shepherd, I remember that, and I didn't much care for that lab. And I'm happy to say that's long gone from the curriculum.
Mm-hmm. I guess I have an assumption as to why they would have you, you know, either test on dogs or test on each other, but I want to hear either what the rationale was or what you thought the rationale was for doing that.
Well, for the dog part, it was surgery. And I think that made me think I was learning surgical technique. And it was really a very coarse introduction, a very crude introduction. And very little did I learn about what I would learn later on on a rotation through the surgical services. I saw it as more of an expansion of seeing a living organ in function, in operating. I think those were my thoughts at the time. As far as doing the other things on yourself, I kind of attached that to the educational philosophy of the day. As a matter of fact, I felt a little bit like I was undergoing an initiation. And that showed up in the clinical years as well. And I've discussed that with some of the faculty subsequently. And that was the mood, the attitude on rounds, for example, later on in the clinical years, had a lot to do with, I won't say quite humiliation, but embarrassing. There was a lot of rigidity and put-downs. And I think maybe that probably started with Dean Middleton. And if you like, I can back up on this one. I'm happy to have the opportunity to do this. Dean Middleton was a wonderful teacher, and everybody loved him. They remembered him well. One of his techniques for which he is most remembered was the Brown Derby. And I, in fact, just viewed a Brown Derby, one that's been preserved in the museum, that he used. Before a class, he would set this handsome Brown Derby on a table. And he would start the session, and he would ask students a question. And the first student that didn't get an answer, or the first student, maybe he'd let one or two go, but they gave the most foolish answer, he would pick up the hat and throw it at him. And the student had to wear it all day, knowing that he answered the dumbest question. And I think that set the tone for the rest of the faculty in many respects, because there was a lot of put-downs. Mm-hmm. And I remember I was so delighted to hear that Dean Middleton was retiring, because I didn't think the new guy would do that, or I'd hoped he wouldn't. and he didn't. But the attitude persisted, and of the faculty, one of them was outstanding, and that was Frank Larson, who humiliated me more than once. A likable guy. And but I learned by by terror, I guess you'd say, as a post note to that, after I had graduated and done my internship and my residency, I came back here for a research fellowship, which included making rounds and teaching some of the classes in hematology. And my fellow teacher was Frank Larson. And I can remember my delight at being a colleague of his, and what a nice guy he was, and how he wasn't nasty at all to me. But I remember he was the one that I remembered best for that, I guess, although there were others that did that. It was not friendly. And I can also compare that to today's teaching, because I spent 2 years here just recently teaching the physical diagnosis class mm-hmm. that I talked about to current medical students. And that is totally changed. It was a delight. We were the present attitude is that students are your friends, and you want to spend time with them and talk about their families and what's going on in their lives. Quite a difference. Mm-hmm. And I think I lived through that transition that happened somewhere in those many years between.
So, I mean, what I'm hearing is that this is somewhat akin to, as you said, initiation, not necessarily hazing by any means, but...
Yes, that's correct. I felt like I was being initiated to the great and noble profession. I mean, there were many other things that did that. I remember that when I showed up for the first time for rounds in my white coat, I had to have the white coat, the tie, all of that, stethoscope in the pocket, and my attending was a much beloved professor, Hans Ries. He was born in Austria, and he set fit right in with that mood. And the first discussion was that when we appear for rounds, we must be on time. If we're late, we will be fined a dime, as will everybody who attend rounds. And I learned that the money is pooled and buys a box of candy for the nurses at that station. Who were also limited in discipline. They had to stand when the attending physician arrived. They, of course, all wore white with the special student. The students had the little over skirts. They all wear caps, except the students. That was what they were striving for. It was quite a structured, rigid thing. Hans Ries one day stopped me at the elevator. I was waiting at the elevator with my hands in my pockets. And he said, "We do not put our hands into pockets." So we were disciplined and initiated.
Do you think that method of education actually helped you learn?
I think the current method would have helped more. I guess learning by terror has some effects. I think it was common. I've had the opportunity to teach graduates of Indian medical schools in more recent years, and they're taught that way, and wrote. And they can recite book and verse from just right on. But they had no clinical experience. And so they showed the same rigidity and the stiffness and the attention to the students. I will give one example of Dean Middleton, why he was a great man, though, to go back to that attitude. And that was, he had a great sense of humor. And he apparently amused the students quite a lot. He was very strict. Another one was that you couldn't smoke in the hospital. In those days, everybody smoked in the hospital, the doctors, the nurses, even the patients in their beds. And a famous story about Middleton was that a medical student was taking in history from a patient, and she said, offered him a cigarette, and he accepted it, knowing he was at risk. The door was open to the corridor. As he was taking the history, he heard footsteps which sounded like the dean to him. So he threw the cigarette on the floor, and the dean came along and looked into the room and saw the cigarette burning on the floor. And he said, "Jones, was that your cigarette?" And the student said, "You saw it first, sir." And the dean did not, the penalty would have been end of medical school. It would kick you out of medical school for smoking. And the student was not. The dean told the story too.
I want to get back to the question of gender.
Mm-hmm.
Because you talked earlier about, you know, what, maybe 10, 12% of your incoming class were women.
That's correct.
And there was this general attitude, it sounds like, about women. I won't put words in your mouth, but what I'm hearing is that that's not, being a doctor is not a woman's place.
Well, I think that in time, that was a transition. The general public felt that way. Being a woman doctor was something special because of the courage that went with it. And the women in our class were, for the most part, courageous, and they showed that. We didn't harass them. We were friendly to them. One of them married a classmate. And that was more than friendly. But it was a different time.
Mm-hmm.
That's all there is to it. Mm-hmm. And I would think that some of that change and some of the acceptance and much of them getting into, I wondered how much of the faculty women, because there were quite a few faculty, I realized just reviewing the faculty at this point, how many were women, and they were also much admired. And many quite successful. One of the names I had forgotten but I remember now is Dr. Bennett, who was the professor of ear, nose, and throat, and a wonderful, delightful person. I really liked her a lot. She was a mountain climber, and she did many of the big mountains. I don't remember what her thing was, but she was, you know, an illustration of what a woman could be, I think, and or could be in those days, what they had to overcome to. Mm-hmm. But there were a number of others. There's one I will mention that was not the favorite of most of my classmates, and that was Helen Dickey, pulmonologist who was described a lot of diseases in farmer's lung, and did a lot of work here in Wisconsin. Very well known, but who did not treat the men at all well, and it was very obvious. She was, she would call on the women in a very friendly way. The men, she said, "Well, what is it, Buster?" That was her favorite term for the men students, was Buster. And I remember that I had a personal run-in with her because I had my car broke down over the Thanksgiving holidays, and I was unable to come back to participate in an experiment on time that she'd initiated. She'd given me, she was working with the tuberculin test and the, what's called the PPD vaccination. And I had to have it read on time, and coming back Thanksgiving night for Friday class, the car broke down on Highway 80 and my dad had to come and get me, and I didn't come, I came back to school the next afternoon. And she said, "You're out of the experiment," and she just put me down and made me think I wasn't going to get a good grade and all that sort of thing.
So after those, well, let me give you space here then. If there's mm-hmm. other things you want to talk about your time in med school.
I think I've actually covered a lot of it in. Our discussion now. There is a feeling among my classmates that it's been expressed as recent as the last few annual reunions about that mood, I think. And there are a number of classmates who've said they left angry. And part of it they attributed that to is the transition and taking away from us that third year of classes. I don't understand that one. I did not leave angry. I left at a time when there was a very different sort of educational approach. Looking back over the years, medicine was quite primitive then, and so many of the principles that were drilled into us don't even apply right now. I think I've covered it, the kinds of memories that I have pretty well.
Okay. Well, there's a couple more things. First, I want to see if this is a good time. You mentioned earlier about Howard Temin.
Yes.
If you want to return to that.
Yeah. Well, that's and that would get into my fellowship, which is I did a. In those days, you had to do a year long rotating internship, which means it was sort of like the senior year repeated. You would do so much time on surgery, so much time on obstetrics, so much pediatrics, internal medicine, so forth. And you went somewhere else to do that. So I did that. I did a year in Washington, D.C. Came back for a residency in internal medicine where I found I really loved hematology. And I then signed up for a fellowship in hematology at Marquette University in Milwaukee. It was then Milwaukee County Hospital. And enjoyed the research part of it to the extent that I wanted to continue it. And so I wrote to one of my favorite professors, Robert Schilling, who was then chairman of the Department of Medicine, but also the head of the hematology division, blood disorders. And Dr. Schilling helped me to obtain a grant from the NIH to come here, working with him and the Department of Genetics together on a study that I proposed. Those were really a couple of the best years of my life. It was very, very exciting, particularly because Schilling gave me the run of the place. He encouraged me to seek out other professors, work with them, write papers with them, work in the labs, and I did that and published a number of papers in that two-year time. I ran a clinic, or I attended a clinic, in chronic lymphocytic leukemia, which was the intended subject of my research, although I went into a lot of other areas. And towards the end, I attended in those days, academics congregated in Atlantic City once every year, in which what became the meat market. It's where jobs were traded. Done on the boardwalk, and that's how I was looking for a position, and over many, many interviews, I obtained the position and signed on to go to a hospital setting and a university in New York. After I came back from that meeting, Bob Schilling told me that Howard Temin would like to meet with me. He works over in the cancer lab, he told me. He's a new person here, and he wants to talk to you about a fellowship. So I went over to meet with him, and my initial impression was, first of all, that he looked like he was about 5 years my junior, and he may have been at that time. He may have been younger than me, I don't know, but he was a very youthful-looking fellow, quite intense on an interview, and what he wanted me to do was study leukemia with cell cultures. I had that skill. I could do cell cultures, but on chickens. And I was anxious to apply clinical skills at this point and not extend my fellowships to another 2 years, and I was excited about going to New York. And I, after giving it some thought, looking at the lab, which included a technician, all of this would be paid for by the NIH on a grant, and was a pretty plush grant, as a matter of fact, I had no idea what it was that he was getting into. He tried to explain it to me, but it was way over my head in terms of the chemistry that went with it. What it was the project to describe reverse transcriptase, for which he won the Nobel Prize. And so I've not regretted that decision. I don't know that I would have gone on in that direction, but it was a notable event in my life, I guess I could say.
So you took this job in New York. When did you make your way back here to Wisconsin, permanently back to Wisconsin?
Just recently, 2008.
Okay.
And I was I ended up as clinical professor of medicine at Stony Brook, and I was one of the professors that I met here encouraged me to apply for an appointment here, even though I was in full retirement. And I was granted that. It took them 2 years to vet me. They have to, now are looking into taking on a professor of medicine, I guess, anywhere else. They have to have every single year and every publication authenticated and proved to be valid and just so. But I actually started before that was completed, and that's where I met with the freshman students, and loved that. It was really an important thing in my life to see the change in medical education.
Mm-hmm. There's one more thing I want to ask, because we haven't actually talked about location. So now, in 2015, the med school has its own...
Yes.
Whatever you want to call it, on the far west side of this campus.
Campus, yeah.
Where did you do most of your work here?
The medical school was, when I came to it, divided into several, two or three buildings. Part of it was the complex that still exists pretty much intact behind and in the university, the old university hospital. But just shortly before I came, I think, they built a new school building, which they called the Service Memorial Institutes. And it's still there, and it's been added on to. It had one large traditional amphitheater-style lecture hall, and labs and offices and smaller classrooms. But in the freshman year, we did our anatomy in Science Hall. And the cadavers that we dissected were on the top floor, which was right under the roof with gables. It was a spooky place. Romantic in a sense that we were doing that. And there were other classrooms there where we did pathology, history, histology, the study of tissues, mm-hmm. with a microscope. That was done in that building too. So there, and then there was very little. I remember that we did get into the hospital a little bit for classrooms, but most of those were used for the clinical years. And there weren't very many of them. They built that hospital without the idea. Medical education was still coming out of the apprenticeship kind of approach, I think. And you really spent your time at the nurse's station and on the wards, and there wasn't much room for discussion. Now they build a lot of classrooms with schools. And we have, and the new campus has a new medical school. It's separate unto itself. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The one more thing I wanted to ask, and then again I'll give you some time at the end, is the reason we got to know each other is that your parents were interviewed
yes.
by one of my predecessors. And I'm wondering, were you able or have you been able to listen to their oral history?
Yes, I have.
So I wonder if that helped you... first off, learn more about them and their time here.
It definitely did. Yes, that was. In that case, my father was 85 years old, had had a stroke, and was becoming frail. He was frail, I think, at that time, and it shows in the lecture. He kind of trails off in his speech and so forth. But I could also hear him perk up when he was asked certain questions and come out of it. He went to law school here, and so the questions that he was asked about law school were and about his courtship of my mother, I think he perked up. That was one interesting thing. My mother was she's the same age, a year difference, at this time, showing a much younger behavior, stronger voice, all of that. And she went on to live to be 100. He died the next year. I learned a lot about her and about her personality, I think. She was a very good student in school and was the valedictorian of her class and won a scholarship to Northwestern. But her friends she was raised a strict Methodist. But she told me as a child and growing up that all the things that she wasn't allowed to do and all the things that she then did when she went to Northwestern, but it wasn't enough. and she knew people apparently from Wisconsin who said, oh, you got to go to Wisconsin. It's party school, and this comes out in her discussion. And she was not a good student, apparently. And she fell in love with one of the professors, or at least a crush. And instead of a final exam answer, she wrote him a poem. You know, obviously she was quite a gal, right, from what I'm hearing. My dad, I learned... Well, I know that from before, that my dad had no money and saved up his lunch money so he could take her to the prom, and that's what, I learned a lot of that stuff. They talked about some of the places they've lived and where they went in that interview, and one of them may have been Ann Emery, went by another name then. But they lived my mother made the transfer from Northwestern here late in the summer, so she didn't get into a dorm or anything like that the first year. So she lived in a had a room somewhere. And I remember trying to place that where that would be, and it's down around, right off State Street, I think, around at the foot of Bascom Hill. Mm. But that's all been... change. She had a job here after they were married at the Historical Society, and used to tell me stories about that. She didn't like her boss, I remember. But it was fun to listen to that interview, yes.
Mm-hmm. So, Dave, is there anything else that you would like to get on this oral history before we wrap it up?
I guess... that pretty well covers it. I think I'm sure that there's much more I could in detail on faculties and things like that, but I'm not the strong memories that I've had, I think, are coming out now, and are I've listened for you.
Well, then I want to thank you for your time today. I do appreciate it. So this concludes the oral history with David Westring.
Thank you.